This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Citizens of the world, here are sounds and melodies from Africa, drumming support for Barack Obama, the Democratic presidential candidate in the United States. Vote Barack Obama. Vote good change. God bless you.
Supporting you, Barack Obama. Welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, where it's now 5 minutes after midnight, and my name is Bill Weinberg, and we're opening up once again with the homage in song to our new president, Barack Obama, by the group Kenge Kenge, which are a group of traditional musicians of the Luo people of Kenya, who are, of course, Obama's peeps. And we played this song on the night of his election back in November, and now we're playing it again. Obviously, they're saying vote Obama, so it was recorded before the election. People are probably aware that Obama's election has been a big deal for the Luo people of Kenya because they've been traditionally excluded from political power in Kenya, which was what, the violence and unrest that we saw in Kenya last year was all about, you know, much as African Americans have been excluded from power here. So his election has been a big inspiration for his own people back in Kenya. I'm going to start off by reading some quotes. I've done a lot of reading to prepare for tonight's show, and I've got a lot of feelings and perceptions which I wish to share, and about this day, which is historic by any standard, no matter how you slice it. And then maybe we'll take phone calls and see what all of you have got to say about this pretty amazing historical juncture that we've arrived at. No matter what you think about it, okay, it's that, okay? Also, once again, the last time that we were that I played that song when I was on the air, the night that that Barack Obama was elected, back in November, we had people who were listening that night will recall, we had a studio full of activists giving their perceptions of what the election means. And there were those who said that it doesn't mean anything at all and that, they were basically playing the leftist sourpuss, which is, traditionally my role. I'm usually the leftist sourpuss around here. But they were even going beyond my habitual dour cynicism. And one of them, and there were also others in the studio that night who were a bit more open-minded about the whole affair, but one of the more skeptical ones read the following quote. "The oppressed are allowed once every few years to decide which particular representatives of the oppressing class shall represent and repress them." There was some contestation as to whether the quote was from Karl Marx or Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. And it turns out that both are kind of right. It's actually from, the verbatim is actually from The State and Revolution by Lenin, 1917. But he says in the text that he's paraphrasing Marx's ideas. So that's one point of view. But I'm going to juxtapose it with another quote. This is verbatim from the old bearded guy himself, Karl Marx, from a letter that he wrote on behalf of the First International in November of 1864, congratulating Abraham Lincoln on his victory. Quote, "We congratulate the American people upon your re-election by a large majority. If resistance to the slave power was the reserved watchword of your first election, the triumphant war cry of your re-election is death to slavery." So, even if Lenin's characterization of Marx's view of the whole affair of bourgeois elections was accurate, The picture is a little bit more complicated, even from the standpoint of Marx's perceptions. Then a quote from Abraham Lincoln himself. On stage at Cooper Union here in New York City, February 27th, 1860. Wrong as we think slavery is, we can yet afford to leave it alone where it is. End quote. And that's pretty typical of a lot of Lincoln's rhetoric at the time, trying to reassure the South. This was, of course, the year before he was elected, trying to reassure the South and head off the crisis which proved inevitable, and making clear that he was not an abolitionist, and distancing himself from the abolitionist. And finally, a quote from Barack Obama at a press conference announcing his energy policy team, December 15th of last year. Quote, "There is not a contradiction between economic growth and sound environmental policies," end quote. Okay, now I'm obviously trying to make a point here. And fundamentally, I think that, yes, there is a contradiction between economic growth and sound environmental policies. I think it's pretty simple math. We live on a planet of finite resources, and the very work of the capitalist system is to take those resources and turn them into consumer goods at an ever-increasing rate. So, obviously, this system is unsustainable. And the invocation of economic growth is buying into what has been the consensus of the political elite in this country for a long time, most dogmatically since the Reagan Revolution, which is that all that we need is to unfetter the free market and it'll take care of all human needs. And that economic growth is the answer. As long as the economy is growing, then, human needs will be met and social problems will spontaneously work themselves out. This is an increasingly discredited ideology. And the system is not yet gone into such a degree of crisis that Obama can state squarely that it has failed, which is pretty much what FDR did in his first inaugural, when he said that the I don't have the verbatim in front of me, but said that the great men who oversee the exchange of the world's goods, their system has failed us. Well, obviously, the system was much, much, much deeper into crisis when FDR took the oath of office than it is now, although it's certainly teetering right on the edge of a very, very profound crisis, and everybody seems to understand this. As it was, mutus mutandi, so to speak, different circumstances, but as it was when Lincoln took the oath of office. And despite, of course, Lincoln's protestations that wrong as we think slavery is, we can yet afford to let it alone where it is, well, it didn't work out that way. At a horrific cost of 600,000 American lives. More lives lost in the Civil War than more American lives lost in the Civil War than in all of the wars that this country has been involved with since then, combined. At this horrific cost, ultimately, the slave system met its doom. But it took the system going that deeply into crisis. And similarly, even to put in place the social safety net and the severe state regulation on capitalism, which took place under FDR, it took the system going very, very, very deeply into crisis. And unlike the slave system under Lincoln, the capitalist system under FDR was never abolished, obviously. But restraints were placed on the worst of its excesses. And in order for that to happen, it took the system going very, very deeply into crisis. So, the question of whether Obama is going to rethink his adherence to what continues to be the ruling political consensus among the, you know, elites of this country. That, you know, there is no contradiction between economic growth and sound economic policies, with all of the free market assumptions which underlie that statement. Whether Obama is going to rethink and ultimately abandon those precepts is going to depend on how deeply the system goes into crisis in the months and years ahead of us. Just as it did for Lincoln and FDR. And if you compare, you know, Lincoln's first inaugural and his second inaugural, well, the first inaugural in 1861, he was bending over backwards to assure the South that he was not an abolitionist, that he did not mean to threaten the slave system where it already existed. He was merely opposed to its expansion into the new territories. And repeated this point over and over again, that he posed no threat to slavery where it already existed. Then if you look at his second inaugural, in 1865, he states flatly that slavery has been the cause of the war. And that in order for the Union to be preserved, it was going to have to be done away with. Neither here, actually, got the text instead of in front of me here. Neither party expected, neither the North or the South, expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained by 1865. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with, or even before the conflict itself might cease. Each looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. But that's not the way it worked out. Here, what else have we got to say here? Right. Talking about at the beginning of the war, 1/8 of the whole population were colored slaves. not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. To strengthen, perpetuate, and extend this interest was the object for which the insurgents would rend the Union even by war, while the government claimed no right to do more than to restrict the territorial enlargement of it, meaning the slave system. So an acknowledgement that things had changed since his first inaugural, and that events had taken on a logic of their own. So, obviously, Obama himself has been, vigorously playing up the Lincoln analogy through lots of, very, very obvious symbolism, including his, taking the same train route, even in this train which was done up to look like, the original 1861 train, this old sort of 19th century style train, from Illinois to Washington. Obama's been very, very consciously playing upon this symbolism. And, there might actually be more to it than Obama himself intends. And I don't view the world from the perspective of, history being made by great men, but of political economy. And ultimately, it was political economy of the slave system which forced greatness upon Lincoln, so to speak. All right, so we just had a little analysis of Lincoln's first and second inaugurals. Why don't we take a look at what we heard today from the mouth of Barack Obama? There's some very favorable stuff, some very hopeful stuff in his first inaugural address that we heard this afternoon, and also some stuff which is a little bit ominous. Let's go first to the stuff which is favorable, to the stuff which is hopeful. He writes that each day brings further evidence that the ways we use energy strengthen our adversaries and threaten our planet. Well, I'm not too crazy about the strengthen our adversaries part, because it sort of plays into xenophobia a little bit, and the demonization of our official enemies, and also into the whole, notion that we're in this, which I would argue is simply objectively the case, in this struggle for control of the planet's hydrocarbon resources, with the people who happen to be sitting on top of them, primarily, although not exclusively, in the Arab world. So I'm not too crazy about that strengthens our adversaries part, but I am very, very happy about the threaten our planet part. And generally, that's a very, very favorable line. Each day brings further evidence that the ways we use energy strengthen our adversaries and threaten our planet. An acknowledgement that we need to break with the fossil fuel economy. This is generally a very favorable line. Okay, then we've got this paragraph here, which is which contains some favorable and some unfavorable phrases. For everywhere we look, there is work to be done. The state of the economy calls for action, bold and swift, and we will act, not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth. So once again, there's that implicit invocation of the ideology of the free market, that limitless growth is either possible or desirable, and that ultimately, an inexorably expanding economy will just take care of everything, as opposed to the notion that resources have actually got to be appropriated and subject to social direction, which is a very different concept. to continue with Obama's text. We will rebuild the roads and bridges, the electric grids and digital lines that feed our commerce and bind us together. We will restore science to its rightful place. Now, that's a good line, and that's a very, very unsubtle jab at Bush, and particularly his denial until very, very recently, until very, very late in his second term, of the reality of global warming and global climate change. We will wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and to lower its cost. We will harness the sun and the winds and the soil to fuel our cars and run our factories. Okay, now there's another line that I'm not too crazy about, because when he says that we're going to harness the sun and the winds, well, okay, that sounds pretty good. But then when he says we're going to harness the soil to fuel our cars, well, that's obviously an invocation of so-called biofuels or agrofuels. And I submit is a bogus solution. And in fact, it has been the explosion over the past couple of years of the biofuel economy, which has helped drive up the price of food. Certainly, we're aware, I hope, that, basically with NAFTA and free trade, there was sort of a bait and switch. I mean, certainly this is very, very clear in Mexico. And it's also, it's gone far beyond Mexico. It's in the whole dynamic with NAFTA is kind of a microcosm of what's been a global pattern. But it's useful to look at what happened with NAFTA, where there was sort of a bait and switch that was pulled on Mexico, where with NAFTA, their markets were flooded with cheap corn. Produced by U.S. agribusiness, and, these big economies of scale, heavily mechanized, very technology intensive, which the traditional, local peasant economies of Mexico could not compete with. The campesino sector could not compete with. So they were forced off of the market. A lot of them lost their lands. A lot of the so-called ejidos, which are the traditional communally held lands, one of the gains of the Mexican Revolution, were privatized and they were lost to the campesino sector. And the economy became very, very dependent on corn, which was imported from the United States. And then it became more profitable for farmers to stop producing corn for export to Mexico and to start producing soy to be turned into biofuels, or corn to be turned into biofuels rather than sold to Mexico for food. So all of a sudden, there wasn't enough corn in Mexico, and the price of tortillas soared, and there were food riots, and et cetera, et cetera. And the same sort of pattern was replicated all over the world. I mean, the impacts of decisions made by U.S. farmers had more of an impact in Mexico than in many other countries. But basically, it was the same pattern, all over the world. So, and the other problem with biofuels, apart from, diverting croplands from food to fuel, is that it doesn't challenge the hegemony of cars. And the fact that, far too much of our of the actual physical landscape, particularly in America, and unfortunately in the United States of America, I should say, and unfortunately this is a pattern which is being replicated throughout the world, has been for the past several generations now. Far too much of the actual physical landscape is devoted to cars. And, the real big ticket numbers are going to be, A, rebuilding mass transportation, and B, even more importantly, I would argue, is, relocalizing the economies and returning things to the human scale and scaling back globalization so that there's less of a need to be, burning either fossil fuels or biofuels in order to, get people to work and to get goods to market and so on. So the whole notion that we're going to harness the soil to fuel our cars is a problematic one. All right, to continue. Here, this is a very favorable passage, returning to Obama's inaugural. As for our common defense, we reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals. Our founding fathers, faced with perils we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law and the rights of man. A charter expanded by the blood of generations. Those ideals still light the world, and we will not give them up for expedience's sake. That's another rather unsubtle dig at the human rights and civil rights violations of the outgoing administration. Let's see. Previous generations who faced down fascism and communism understood that our power alone, cannot protect us, nor does it entitle us to do as we please. Once again, an unsubtle dig at George Bush and the invasion of Iraq. Instead, they knew that our power grows through its prudent use. Our security emanates from the justness of our cause, the force of our example, the tempering qualities of humility and restraint. So I would like to interpret this as a warning against reckless military interventionism. One hopes that's what he means. I think it's pretty clear that's what he means. We are the keepers of this legacy, guided by these principles, etc., etc. We will begin to responsibly leave Iraq to its people and to forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. With old friends and former foes, we will work tirelessly to lessen the nuclear threat and roll back the specter of a warming planet. All right, so this would seem to imply that he's talking about bringing in the military tentacles that the U.S. has got around the world and beginning to concentrate more on addressing global warming and addressing nuclear disarmament. This is good. But then in the very next line, he says, we will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense. And for those who seek to advance their aims by inducing terror and slaughtering innocents, we say to you now that our spirit is stronger and cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us, and we will defeat you. Well, what exactly does he mean by our way of life? Now, if he's talking about our way of life in terms of civil liberties and, you know, elbow room for freedom, then I'm with him. But if he's talking about our way of life, meaning profligate use of the planet's resources, particularly petrochemical resources, and, you know, a highly using a highly disproportionate share of the planet's resources, which, you know, necessarily entails keeping down the developing world. Well, I'm not with him. And unfortunately, that's kind of a vague phrase, our way of life. And politicians have traditionally kind of used it to mean either one or the other or both, or most dangerously conflating the two. So I'm not so sure about that phrase. And the rest of the quote as well would seem to loan some credence to the notion of the global war on terrorism, even though he apparently is going to at least drop the nomenclature of the global war on terrorism, drop the phrase, which is at least a start. All right. Okay, then my favorite line. We know that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness. We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers. Oh, what a breath of fresh air. What a breath of fresh air to actually have a president in his inaugural invoke atheists and acknowledge that we are entitled to a dignified place in the United States of America. What a relief. And good that he invoked Muslims, too. But he gets extra kudos for invoking non-believers. Right on, Obama. All right, so there we go. A little spot analysis of Barack Obama's first inaugural. And it's going to be very interesting to watch where it goes from here. I still have a lot of things to say, but you know what? I'm going to take a brief musical break because I need to go across the room and put on my sweater because I'm freezing. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to hear a little bit more of Kenge Kenge. This is from their album Introducing Kenge Kenge, which is from the Introducing series. You can it's part of the worldmusic.net outfit. You can check them out online at worldmusic.net. As the name might imply, the first song that we heard, which is Obama for Change, that I got off the internet, but this is from their disc, which I also happen to have. So here, let's hear a little bit more of Kenge Kenge while I go put on my sweater, and then we shall continue forthwith with this exploration.
shadow kwa nyachungo zangu. Kutie kubaya, sumaski kote mielo tumie. Kutie kubaya, nipolo zeto chungo zangu. Kutie kuni, vise mwabebe mielo tumie. Kukono dola, obongo juni ya mano siyepie. Kutie kuni, nibilo niti chungo zake. Koloyo pako, wanyango leo mielo tumie. Kamielo chacha jali nyara lego chungo miela. Anile mayan mielo tumie, kutie pini, nijabo tosa mielo tumie, kutie pini, nijabo tosa mielo tumie, tuwero rumo, wana inda koro rikie, niwero rumo, wana inda koro rikie, ya telo mageno, kutie pa koro rikie, ya telo makonya.
A little bit more from Kenge Kenge, traditional music of the Luo people of Kenya. Okay, now let's see if I can get through optimistically in the next 15 minutes so we can take listener phone calls for the last half hour. That might be a little bit too optimistic, but I'll try. I'll try to keep rocking along here. My readings. And the first thing I want to read is a letter from a listener. Because I said that I was going to prepare for tonight's show, I was going to read the book Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln by Doris Kearns Goodwin, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, which is an analysis of Lincoln's cabinet. And the reason I wanted to read it in particular was because it had apparently influenced Obama. And I'm trying to, you know, understand who and what Obama is and what his strategies are. So one reader, one Larry Cross of the Bronx, takes issue with my taste in reading. Dear Bill, you recently hinted to your listening audience that you will be reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book on Lincoln's cabinet. This is a part of your scholarly repertoire of books, I assume, and the main source of inspiration for this intellectual endeavor came from the president-elect Barack Obama, the man you were rooting for. Please beware of the fact that Ms. Goodwin is a mainstream historian who is seeking to preserve the status quo, along with U.S. hegemony around the world. She's not seeking to tear down the edifice of capitalism by way of harsh criticism, nor through the social weapon of mass action protest. What you ought to be reading instead is Kenneth O'Reilly's monumental work, Nixon's Piano. In this masterful work, Professor O'Reilly shows, through extensive documentation, how most presidential aspirants, from Washington to Clinton, have employed the race card factor to appeal to those racist white voters north and south. You should also include in your reading list the scholarly work of Bayford Logan, The Betrayal of the Negro, from Rutherford Hayes to Woodrow Wilson. Again, this work shows how the depths of presidential politics revolves around the race question, especially if one wants to garner enough white votes to be elected to office. And in the final analysis, this will only serve to undermine black legislative gains, both in both civil rights and employment as well. Now that Senator Obama has been elected, we can also expect the same thing in terms of racial appeals to whites. Witness the Sean Bell shooting by rogue cops. Obama has endorsed Judge Cooperman's not guilty verdict in glowing terms. This is also coupled by his support of the Zionist against the beleaguered Palestinian people, as well with members of the Trilateral Commission at his side. Nothing will change along the racial militaristic way of doing things. Thus, our only salvation lies in building a strong mass movement around social, economic, and political lines. If each ethnic group wants to organize their own group around these issues, then so be it. All right. Well, thank you for your letter, Larry. I always appreciate it when listeners take the time to put pen to paper, as you literally did. I especially appreciate that you actually wrote a letter, well, not even on a computer, but with your own hand. And I especially thank you for the book suggestions, which I always appreciate. And I did, in fact, I didn't have time to go to the library, but I read some excerpts of both of those books online, and they both sound quite worthwhile. The reference to Nixon's Piano, apparently, is a sort of a cabaret routine that Nixon and Agnew did at a private party, where they did this sort of appalling sort of blackface kind of thing. They didn't literally put on blackface, but they really sort of mimicked a black style in very, very condescending terms. And it was sort of, you know, really throwing a wink to the to their audience that, or not even throwing a wink. It was just a real blatantly racist send up. I mean, because it was behind closed doors, so to speak, but word of it got out. But all of his rhetoric, of course, was, you know, about law and order and so on, was, you know, racially coded, right? But the thing is, you know, I understand this, you know? I mean, particularly since the election of, 1876, if memory serves, with the sleazy backroom deal that put Rutherford Bayes in the White House, you know, Reconstruction came to an end, and the Lincoln legacy of the Republican Party was utterly betrayed, and the overwhelmingly African American state militias in the South, which had been, you know, backed up by the federal army, were disbanded, and that was the beginning of Klan terror and Jim Crow, and the beginning of the Republican Party that we all know and love today. And so that, you know, the Republican Party that we, the sort of the post-Lincoln Republican Party, was sort of, you know, founded by a conscious act of betrayal. And that became much more blatant with Barry Goldwater's so-called Southern strategy, which really sort of set the template for a more blatant betrayal, you know, using these, you know, code words and so on of, not just sort of a passive betrayal, such as Rutherford Hayes did, but a real sort of active demonization of black folk in this country as sort of, you know, a pillar of achieving power. You know, that was really what was forged by Barry Goldwater in the Southern Strategy, which was used to great effect by Nixon and to great effect once again by Reagan and all of the Republican presidents since then, and even to a certain extent the Democratic ones. So, but the thing is, I lived through that. You know, all the stuff since Barry Goldwater, I lived through and I watched it happen. And yeah, those books sound like they're worth reading. But, the one word in your letter, which I take issue with, is instead. Because, you know, the reason I wanted to read Team of Rivals is because, it influenced Obama. And I want to understand Obama because he represents something different. Now, I don't know how radically different, but obviously something has changed in terms of the way, race works in politics in this country. Obviously, something has changed. It may or may not be particularly meaningful, but one way or another, something has changed. And there's all of this, as with getting back to... All right, actually, here, let me talk about this a little bit. Let me talk about... is there anything else in the letter which I... anything else in the letter which I need to address? We're finally, your last line, our only salvation lies in building a mass movement around social, economic, and political lines. Of course, I agree wholeheartedly. And I don't think that taking at least a little comfort in the election of Obama is necessarily exclusive to the notion of building a mass fighting movement along social, economic, and political lines, all right? And that's sort of the case which I'm going to try to make in the remaining 5 or 10 minutes, so then we can take some listener phone calls. Now, the really interesting thing about Team of Rivals, which I don't regret reading, is that it's a real... it's interesting on two points. On one point, it's a real blow-by-blow of how Lincoln finessed the issue of slavery and emancipation and how he was sort of brought around by political circumstance, kicking and screaming, as it were, to finally having to, as he perceived it, embrace abolition in order to preserve the Union. After, the system had gone very, very deeply at the crisis and the war had lasted much, much, much longer and had been far more destructive than anybody had anticipated when it began. All right. Now, related to that is the second thing which makes the book interesting, which is, and here's where it gets into perhaps how it loans a key to understanding the mind of Barack Obama, is that it's a study in how Lincoln balanced the rival, both personalities and the politics which these personalities represented in his own cabinet. And, on the left of his cabinet, he was his Treasury Secretary, Salmon P. Chase, who was a fiery abolitionist and not only, an abolitionist, but even more radical, a proponent of equal rights for blacks and a proponent of doing away with the so-called black codes, which existed even in many northern states, which denied blacks the franchise, the right to hold office, the right to sit on juries, etc. So he not only supported abolition, but supported doing away with the black codes, North and South, and equal rights. He was on the left of Lincoln's cabinet. On the right of Lincoln's cabinet was Attorney General Edward Bates, who shared the Republican Party line, the sort of minimum, the minimum position, the minimal position of the Republican Party, which is that we don't support extending slavery beyond where it already exists into the territories. He supported that, but he was from a state which was already a slave state, Missouri, under the Missouri Compromise, already a slave state. So he thought that slavery was okay in Missouri to the point where he owned slaves. So he was on the extreme right of Lincoln's cabinet. And then in the middle were Secretary of State William H. Seward and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. And Lincoln himself would have been in the middle between these two extremes. And once again, you know, I mean, each sort of sector of the body politic of the Union was represented by these personalities. And this was key to keeping the Union together and to keeping, you know, the so-called war Democrats on board, the Democrats who had broken with the Democratic Party, which that wing, the majority wing of the Democratic Party, which supported slavery and secession, but were still kind of, you know, suspicious of the Republicans and suspicious of the Republican aim of not extending slavery, but they wanted to preserve the Union, so they supported the war. So, you know, he needed to keep those people on board as well as keeping on board, you know, Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips and the, Thaddeus Stevens and the abolitionists who, thought that he was, you know, giving too much to the war Democrats and were sort of pushing him from the left. So he needed, you know, both of these parties in order to extend, you know, in order to keep together the coalition, which was backing the Union. And anyway, so the book is a very interesting study in all of this and sort of shows how the ultimately the events sort of propelled the abolitionists into gaining the upper hand after, once again, a really, really terrible cost. So now if we look at Obama's cabinet, his embryonic cabinet, which is just beginning to come together here, well, on the right, the Edward Bates, so to speak, of his cabinet would be Robert Gates. They even rhyme, Bates Gates, you know, who's, you know, the holdover from the Republican administration. You could also make an analogy to Edwin Stanton, who was a holdover from the previous Democratic administration, the James Monroe, James Buchanan administration, which was the Democratic administration, which had been appeasing the South and going along with their aims of expanding the slave system into the West. And Edwin Stanton, like Robert Gates, was, you know, Secretary of War, Secretary of Defense, as we call them today. Although Bates was further to the right than Stanton. Certainly you may draw analogies between Robert Gates and Edward Bates or Edwin Stanton. There's a pretty clear analogy between William Seward and Hillary Clinton. Okay. Seward was a senator from New York State. He was somewhat more to the right or more to the center than Lincoln, but not dramatically so. And he was considered to be a shoe-in for the party's nomination at the beginning of the campaign. And Lincoln sort of came from behind and usurped him and then made him Secretary of State. So very, very clear analogy to Hillary Clinton. So this leaves open the question of who is Lincoln's Salmon Chase? Who's, you know, going to be the cabinet member who's going to be on the far, rather, who is Obama's Salmon Chase? Who is going to be the, who is going to be the cabinet member who's going to be on the far left of the Obama administration? Well, he's not there yet. He or she is not there yet. So, let's just keep watching. Let's just keep watching and see what happens. Because as I said from the beginning, that, you know, how far to the left Obama goes is going to be dependent in large part on how deeply into crisis the system goes. And if they do manage to pull things back from the brink in short order, then, you know, Obama could just sort of be like, you know, Bill Clinton Redux, which, you know, like all of my more radical than thou friends are saying. But things could work out differently. And, you know, despite all of Lincoln's protestations that, you know, he didn't mean any threat to the slave system. Well, right away, you know, the proof of the pudding, even before he came around on the issue by 1863, the proof of the pudding was really there in 1861 with the secession of the South. They didn't buy all of his talk about, you know, all of his endlessly reassuring talk about how he didn't mean any threat to the slave system. Quite obviously, they didn't buy it. You know, the massive, overwhelming fact of the South's secession is evidence of that. And just looking, for instance, at the international tip, the atrocity that we just saw in Gaza, I think an analogy can be made there, that as much as Obama is bending over backwards to reassure the neocons and the Zionists and, you know, Israel's Amen chorus and Israel, you know, as Israel's Amen chorus in the United States, as well as the Israeli state itself, as much as he's bending over backwards to reassure them that, you know, he's completely pro-Israel, nothing to worry about, I don't think it's any coincidence that Israel launched this attack on Gaza just before the presidential transition and ended it immediately before the presidential transition, on the very eve of the presidential transition. Now, it's true that the, you know, ceasefire came to an end, although we've already analyzed how Israel's own actions sort of made that inevitable. But I think it's very, very telling that Israel, you know, decided to end the aggression right on the very eve of the presidential transition. I think those facts speak loud and clear that they did not entirely trust Obama, at least did not entirely trust Obama, to give them a green light the way the Bush administration did, to refrain from using refrain at the UN from pushing through any resolutions which would condemn the aggression. And ultimately, finally, you know, when things got really, really out of hand, the Bush administration finally refrained from using their veto and abstained from, rather than voting with Israel, they abstained. But did, you know, refrain from using their veto. And finally, after the aggression had been going on for more than, what, 2.5 weeks, allowed the Security Council to pass a resolution against it. But, you know, they could have refrain from using the veto right from the very beginning. And that wouldn't have been good. You know, then there would have been more pressure on Israel right from the very beginning. So I think that those facts speak pretty loud and clear that the Israeli state did not trust how the Obama administration would behave at the UN on this question and would not just give them the kind of free hand that that the Bush administration gave them. So I think that, you know, just as the secession of the South belied all of Lincoln's rhetoric about how he didn't mean any threat to the slave system, I think that Israel's actions belie some of Obama's rhetoric about, just going along with what has been the U.S. consensus on the Middle East, and particularly the question of Palestine. So another thing which gives me hope that even on the question, the more fundamental question, ultimately, especially in terms of what the American political system is going to look like, I keep on invoking this notion of economic growth that he felt that he has to pay lip service to in some recent quotes, including in the inaugural this afternoon. Which is just saying that he goes along with, the consensus that the free market will take care of everything. One thing which gives me hope is, I'm going to read a passage now from Obama's memoir, Dreams from My Father, where he's back in the 1980s, he's working as a community organizer at the Altgeld and Roseland housing projects in Chicago, and particularly working on trying to, get the area reindustrialized and get some jobs for the folks in these housing projects. After all the factory zones of this part of Chicago along the Calumet River had fled in the globalization and deindustrialization of the 1980s. So he writes, as I thought about Altgeld and Roseland, the housing projects where he was working, I saw those Jakarta markets. No, I'm sorry. I should start a little bit further here. Okay, right. Okay, here we go. As we walk back to the car after a meeting with some residents from the Altgeld and Roseland housing projects, as we walk back to the car, we passed a small clothing store full of cheap dresses and brightly colored sweaters, two aging white mannequins now painted black in the window. The store was poorly lit, but towards the back, I could make out the figure of a young Korean woman, sewing by hand as a child slept beside her. The scene took me back to my childhood, to the markets of Indonesia. The hawkers, the leather workers, the old women chewing betel nut and swatting flies off their fruit with whisk brooms. I'd always taken such markets for granted, part of the natural order of things. Now, as I thought about Altgeld and Roseland, I saw those Jakarta markets for what they were. Fragile, precious things. The people who sold their goods there might have been poorer. Poorer even than the folks in Altgeld. They hauled 50 pounds of firewood on their backs every day. They ate little and died young. And yet, for all that poverty, there remained in their lives a discernible order, a tapestry of trading routes and middlemen, bribes to pay and customs to observe, the habits of a generation played out every day beneath the bargaining and the noise and the swirling dust. It was the absence of such coherence that made places like Altgeld so desperate, I thought to myself. It was the loss of order that made the residents so bitter. For how could we go about stitching a culture back together once it was torn? How long might it take in this land of dollars? longer than it took a culture to unravel, I suspected. I tried to imagine the Indonesian workers who were now making their way to the sorts of factories that had once sat along the banks of the Kalimut River, joining the ranks of wage labor to assemble the radios and sneakers sold on Michigan Avenue. I imagined those same Indonesian workers 10, 20 years from now, when their factories would have closed down, a consequence of new technology or lower wages in some other part of the globe. And then the bitter discovery that their markets had vanished, that they no longer remember how to weave their own baskets or carve their own furniture or grow their own food, that even if they remember such craft, the forests that gave them wood are now owned by the timber interests. The baskets they once wove have now been replaced by more durable plastics. The very existence of the factories, the timber interests, the plastic manufacturer, will have rendered their culture obsolete. The values of hard work and individual initiative turn out to have depended on a system of belief that's been scrambled by migration and urbanization and imported TV reruns. Some of them would prosper in the new order. Some would move to America. And when the others, the millions left behind in Jakarta or Lagos or the West Bank, they would settle into their own Altgeld gardens, into a deeper despair. All right. Now, to me, this passage could only have been written by somebody who fundamentally understands the workaday destruction which is being wrought by the capitalist system. And how, nearly appealing to the values of hard work and individual initiative, as, you know, the Republicans have been doing for all of these years, sometimes in terms which have been pretty openly coded racist terms. Merely appealing to those values in a moralistic kind of way is insufficient, because the erosion or perceived erosion of those values has to do with questions, once again, of political economy. To me, that passage could only have been written by somebody who, on some fundamental level, gets it. Now, this is not to say that Obama is not going to be co-opted by the very system which, on some level, he has a critique of. He may. And once again, I submit that this may have to do with how deeply the system goes into crisis on his watch, and whether his intellectual critique, which I am certain on some level he has, of capitalism, will come to the fore or be pushed off to the side and buried somewhere deep in his psyche. I'm going to read one more brief passage from one of my favorite books. And then, well, maybe we'll have 10 minutes left to take a few listener phone calls. I'm going to read a passage from a biography of one of my personal heroes, the great Italian-American anarchist Carlo Tresca of the 1930s and 40s. The book is All the Right Enemies, The Life and Murder of Carlo Tresca, by Dorothy Gallagher, the reference to the fact that he had all the right enemies, so we don't know who actually killed him in, I believe, 1945, I believe it was the year. Could have been Russian agents, could have been Mussolini's agents, could have been the mafia. He had a lot of enemies, and they were all the right enemies to have at that point. So I'm going to read, in the fall of 1940, Tresca dropped his opposition to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1934, he had written of Roosevelt as an industrial and social dictator whose attempts at reform served to preserve the failing capitalist system. But in the November 14, 1940 issue of Il Martello, which was the Italian-American anarchist journal of the day, which he edited, he wrote, and here a direct quote from Carlo Tresca, "Roosevelt has been reelected. by a large majority. It's all the same to us, the distinguished revolutionist will say, guzzling a bottle of good, bad, or indifferent wine. It's all the same to us, will say those who delight in dulling their minds by a constant repetition of the sacred principles. To me, it does make a difference. Wilkie's election, the Democratic candidate Wendell Wilkie, Wilkie's election would have frozen my blood. Roosevelt's warmed it up. I say this in all frankness and sincerity because in these times to hide one's emotions is hypocrisy. I am not a hypocrite. I immediately thought that Roosevelt's re-election would be regarded by the whole world as a moral and material defeat for the Axis. And it is my belief that in this tragic hour, the most important task of the human race is to strike a death blow to Nazism and fascism. I do fervently hope that the crushing defeat will be inflicted on Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin. And he includes Stalin in with the Axis here because he's writing in 1940, which you will recall was during the period of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, when Stalin was allied with fascism, something I know many of you out there would like to forget. So to continue with the words of Carlo Tresca, reason tells us that this is an imperialist war. Sentiment impels us to preference one of the fighting camps. Come, in this hour so utterly bestial, so somber and threatening, there is no need to confine our emotions in the straitjacket of dogmas, doctrines, and immutable principles. Okay, and I have to confess that this sums up perfectly exactly how I felt on the night of Obama's election and exactly how I feel tonight. Okay? I mean, I'll confess it because I'm not going to be a hypocrite, just like Carlo Tresca said. You know, I'll admit it, that even though, you know, my reason tells me that the Democratic Party is a party of the elites, of elite power, of the rich, of the capitalist system, of globalization, and ultimately of war. I can't help but to take heart at the political transition which we witness today for a number of reasons. One of which is, you know, simply, and this to a certain extent, this transcends politics, is that, both political debate generally, both on the pathetic little remnants of the left as well as the, you know, utterly hegemonic right for the past 30 years or so, has been dramatically dumbed down. So to a certain extent, the question of intelligence transcends politics. But it doesn't really, because ultimately nothing transcends politics. Nothing which concerns human beings transcends politics. And while, you know, certainly I'm very concerned with the dumbing down of the left, because I'm a part of the left, really what's more at issue here is the dumbing down of the right. Because the right, the idiot right, has been in power, at least since Reagan, and it's been getting, you know, more and more stridently and proudly stupid the whole time that it's been in power. And in this, you know, whole supposed, they've, you know, built their whole, political strategy ever since Reagan, but increasingly for the last 8 years under Bush, they've built their whole political strategy over, you know, this notion of, standing up for the little guy against the elites. And in the meantime, you know, in the name of this, you know, they're supporting the oil oligarchs, you know, like Cheney. And I mean, it's just mind boggling, you know, that people could be this stupid. And that's really the key here is because, you know, they've made stupidity not only respectable, but something to be proud of. And the way this bogus anti-elitism, as opposed to real anti-elitism, this bogus anti-elitism, the way it works is that, you know, not, you know, that we shouldn't have, society being run by the rich and in the you know, decisions of foreign policy made in the interests of oil companies. No, 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 no. The way it works is that we don't trust anybody who has a college education. We don't trust anybody who can put a coherent sentence together. So, you know, it's rather an irony that, you know, George Bush, representing a political bloc, which, you know, has played to the most... to the most vulgar xenophobia and, you know, all of these, you know, English-only initiatives and so on, can't even speak the English language. And now we've got a president who repudiates xenophobia, whose father was a Luo from Kenya, whose name is Barack Hussein Obama, who has got, you know, the impeccable eloquence of... a Martin Luther King Jr. or an Abraham Lincoln, and is a damn good writer, because I read Dreams from My Father, and it's a damn good book, and it wasn't ghostwritten. Every word of it is from the heart. So there isn't going to be any hope whatsoever for anything in the political realm if people don't learn how to think. And you can't think, as, you know, Orwell is... explained time and time again, you can't think unless you can read and write. And the whole, you know, degradation of language, which we have witnessed not only in the political realm, but across society over the past 30 years, now maybe can begin to be reversed. If only, you know, because we've got somebody in the bully pulpit who has got, you know, an impeccable command of the English language, and somebody who's actually, you know, not only, you know, has a law degree but earned it, and somebody who, you know, values books and learning and intelligence. And okay, I'm as disconcerted as anybody by you know, we're going to have to fight this battle with Obama over all these, you know, pseudo solutions. For instance, on the question of global warming, pseudo solutions, you know, agro fuels or biofuels and carbon trading. And, you know, all these people who he's, you know, appointed to the Energy Department and to his and to the EPA and so on, or, you know, big boosters of these, what I submit are pseudo solutions. But, you know, that battle is going to have to be fought. Let's fight it. Obama acknowledges that global warming exists. Bush, until very, very recently, didn't. So as long as you've got a president who denies that global warming exists, all you can do is jump up and down and say, yes, it does, yes, it does, yes, it does, yes, it does. Once you've got a president who acknowledges that it exists and he's just going along with these, you know, sort of capitalist consensus pseudo solutions, which would ultimately leave everything up to the magic of the market, you know, carbon trading and biofuels. Okay, then we can have the political fight that needs to be had. You know, then there's enough common ground acknowledging that the problem exists that we can have the political fight that needs to be had. We can fight against biofuels and fight against carbon trading and understand that, no, we can't leave things up to the magic of the market, that ultimately that's a dead end. And we can begin to at least bring back into political discourse in this country and in this world the notion that capitalism, like the slave system of the antebellum South, must grow in order to survive, must continue to eat more territory, resources, labor, in order to survive. And that we can't sober up by drinking martinis and leave it to the magic of the market. And that what's needed is a seizure of the apparatus of capitalism by the public sector and its forcible redirection in the public interest. And if we can't call it socialism, because that's a word which has outlived its utility and has got too much baggage, then maybe we'll have to call it something else. Call it steady state economics or something else. I'm almost afraid to say green economics because that's already been completely co-opted. But it's not the name that matters. It's the idea that matters. And maybe now, maybe we can have the argument that needs to be had and begin to reintroduce this idea into political discourse. Obviously, I'm not going to have time for phone calls. I ranted my way through the whole show. So I'm just going to keep on ranting, and maybe we'll take phone calls about this next week. I'm going to rant a little bit more, and then we're going to go out with a little bit more of Kenge Kenge. So, you know, when all of the controversy around Rick Warren, this homophobic, very, very problematic preacher who gave the invocation at the inaugural today. I'm as disturbed as anybody by Obama legitimizing this kind of politics. Just as Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison and the abolitionists back in the day were disturbed by Lincoln's embrace of the slaveholder Edward Bates in his cabinet. But I'll also note that the pastor who gave the invocation at the big party on the mall on Sunday was the first openly gay Episcopal bishop from New Hampshire, Eugene Robinson. So I sort of understand, especially having read Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin, I sort of understand what Obama is trying to do. That he's trying to rebuild a sense of national unity and begin to move the political center of gravity back towards, not back to the left, but back towards what used to be the political center before the Reagan Revolution. And this late in the day, with the stakes this high, I say with no illusions, I say being prepared to fight for the next 4 years, maybe it's a start. You know, we don't have time for phone calls. I'm really sorry. I didn't intend to rant for the whole show, but I wanted to get through all that material. So I'll tell you what. If anybody really has anything to say, call my voicemail, leave a message, 212-631-1115, 212-631-1115. I'll give the number one more time, 212-631-1115, or hold your thought. Maybe next week we will take phone calls on these questions, because I really am very curious as to what you all have to say about, you know, what are your thoughts and feelings about this new era which we're entering here. We're going to find out in the weeks, months, and years to come just how new it is. Maybe it's not that new, or maybe it's going to be newer than we can imagine. Okay. We're going to go out with a little bit more Kenge Kenge, traditional luo music from Kenya. Do stay tuned for Weaponry with Tom Whisker, coming up next on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM. This has been the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade with me, Bill Weinberg. See you next week. Shalom Aleichem and Salam Aleichem. We'll be right back.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.